welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Rylan. We're mixing things up a little bit this week, switching our book and film reviews, so for all you tuning in for a literary hit, fear not, it will be back tomorrow. Today, however, we are talking film, and more specifically, films by Stanley Kubrick. I'm joined in the studio today by Executive Director of East London's Rio Cinema, Oliver Meek, to discuss a special event taking place later this month. Oliver, welcome to the program. Now, the event in question that we're talking about is called St. Leonard's Horses. Why is that?
This event came about last month when I was approached by this musician, Kieran Leonard, aka St. Leonard's Horses. And actually his manager approached me to say that he'd recently collaborated with Stanley Kubrick's grandson to record his new album. And I was intrigued by the idea, so I met up with Kieran. And having read a little bit about him, I saw that he'd collaborated with some artists that I really liked. I mean, he'd toured the States with Ryan Adams, and he'd been to Father John Misty's wedding. And fascinatingly, he had been put in touch with Jack, Kubrick's grandson, having written a song previously that was about a Kubrick film. And Jack liked his music and offered him the opportunity to come to Kubrick's estate just outside of Tring and record his new album there, with Jack working as a, you know, working on the album with him, helping engineer it. So we decided to have a live performance of some of the songs and match it up with a Kubrick film afterwards. So we've chosen Dr. Strangelove.
Oh, fantastic choice.
Fantastic choice. You know, 50 years old and still, you know, scarily relevant now.
Yes. I mean, for people who maybe weren't around to see it the first time, it might actually feel more relevant than they might have thought it would be maybe a couple of years ago.
Yes. I mean, a certain kind of American president in waiting, you know.
I don't know who you're talking about.
Yeah. There may be a resonance there. But basically, it was kind of almost impossible to choose a Kubrick film because you're so spoilt for choice. But obviously...
Very good problem to have.
Yeah, yeah. But obviously, there's a bit of a kind of Kubrick resurgence at the moment with the exhibition and some screenings at Somerset House. So we picked Dr. Strangelove to match up with this. So it should be a really interesting evening. And before the film, we're screening a short film, which is about 10 minutes long, which shows them recording the album at the house. And if you're a Kubrick fan, you must come along and see it, because basically Kubrick's house has many of the props and items from previous films. Like, I understand in the kitchen it has the coffee table from The Shining, and as you go into the house, all the masks from Eyes Wide Shut are along the wall. So
amazing.
Be great to have a kind of a sneak peek inside the estate of Kubrick.
From what I understand, a lot of the effects, a lot of the details that you see in a lot of Kubrick's films, a lot of them came to fruition at home. He did a lot of his work in his own four walls. I think I recall seeing some footage some time ago of him excitingly creating some of the bizarre visual effects that you might see in 2001, A Space Odyssey. So, I mean, there is something to be said about doing something in a location like that, isn't it? It's more than just a few four walls. I mean, you come from a cinema which, of course, has its own rich history as well. I mean, for someone like me who watches a lot of films, I certainly get a much richer experience and maybe a fuzzy sentimental feeling from seeing it in a beautiful old cinema compared to maybe some of the newer multiplexes. There is something about being in a location like that, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, there's a story behind good music, usually. So kind of linking those things together, that's why they were so keen to do, you know, to play songs from the album in a cinema with that, you know, because of that association with Kubrick. And yeah, as you were saying, I mean, I understand that much of kind of Barry Lyndon was shot on Kubrick's estate. And because he was such a workaholic, he couldn't help but, you know, be working on his films at home.
And a lot of people have remarked upon the kind of music that Kubrick uses in his films. I mean, that was a very major part in all of his movies, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the soundtracks are fantastic for all of them.
So how do you see this playing out in the Rio cinema? Because, I mean, I was touching upon how the location and the atmosphere really plays a large role in all of this as well. But, I mean, wouldn't necessarily be used to seeing a musician playing something in a cinema. How does that all work?
Well, actually, we've had quite a few bands play there in the past, and because it's such a big theatre, but, you know, because it's so old, the acoustics are fantastic in there. And of course, you know, the cinema was showing films way back when sound quality was nowhere near as good, so the amplification of the auditorium was really, really important. So it's a great venue for music, and we've got a really big stage in front of the screen as well.
So you're showing Dr. Strangelove to begin with, but there's also further Kubrick films to come as well.
Well, this is just part of a one-off event, but we'll certainly be showing some more Kubrick films later because there's a fantastic new print of Barry Lyndon, which we'll have one Sunday afternoon coming up.
What's the sort of reception that Kubrick films get today? Because, I mean, obviously they're films that have a very large place in cultural lore. People are always going back to revisit his films. I mean, you can get beautiful editions of them on Blu-ray and so forth. Why do people keep coming back to the cinemas to see these increasingly older films?
Well, happily, they always get a very big following, and that's actually not always the case for a lot of classic films. And, you know, we regularly show classic films at the Rio, but Kubrick always seems to have a big appeal. And I think it's simply because people know that's an experience they have in a cinema. It's not really the same watching, you know, you couldn't watch Barry Lyndon on your phone or, you know, on your laptop. It just wouldn't be the same thing. He put so much attention to detail and was such a master that really that's an experience you have to have in the cinema. So even though all of those films are widely available and, you know, shown on TV, when there is the chance to see them on the big screen, people do usually take it up.
And that's often the key to these sorts of directors attracting new fans as well, because I know just from my own experience when I was growing up in Australia, and there weren't always the beautiful old cinemas that would be showing older films. When you did come across a cinema like that, or you happen to have a very special screening of an older film, sometimes that can be the key to maybe becoming a fan of someone that you otherwise would have never known about. Do you still think that is the case for some of the people that come to the Rio and see some of the older films like the Kubrick films?
Absolutely. I mean, just last month, we had a season of Tarkovsky films. And again, happily, they were really, really well attended. Particularly nice when you show the films of a master like that and you get a good turnout. And I think in one of the films, one woman brought her, you know, 13 and 14-year-old sons to come and see the films, which was fantastic. And I hope that people come and they get it when they get a taste seeing one of those on the big screen. It means that they want to see the rest of the films.
So recap again a little bit of what people can expect at the Rio. And this is coming up relatively soon, isn't it?
It's on the 15th of September. So we'll start at about 8:30. We'll have an introduction. We'll have a short film based at Kubrick's house. And then St. Leonard's Horses will play a set of the songs. There'll then be a short Q&A, hopefully hosted by Jonathan Meads. And then we will show Dr. Strangelove in full.
So that is St. Leonard's Horses performing at the Rio Cinema in Dalston on the 15th of September, and their album Good Luck Everybody will be out on the 14th of October. Oliver Meek from the Rio Cinema here in London, thank you. And now for a preview of what to expect on the cinema show this week. Now, to most of us, the name James Foley recalls one of the most horrific acts to transpire in the ongoing Syrian conflict. The execution of the journalist by the so-called Islamic State in 2014 launched the terrorist group into the world headlines, but you won't see those haunting images of his final moments in this new documentary. Brian Oakes was a friend of Foley's since the pair were growing up together. His new film is simply titled Jim and seeks to redirect the dialogue surrounding James Foley away from the propaganda of his murder and back to the crucial journalism that ultimately cost him his life. I spoke to Brian for this week's edition of The Cinema Show here on Monocle 24. Here's a preview.
Jim was a good friend of mine. We grew up together in a little small rural town in New Hampshire in the United States. We got to really, since we were 7 years old, is kind of when we became friends. And, you know, we had a really normal upbringing, and there's a kind of a naivete in America growing up in small town. You know, we weren't in a big city. So, yeah, that's kind of the background of my life with Jim. And we knew, you know, we stayed in touch our entire lives through university and through our careers. And as Jim became a journalist, I would follow him on his endeavors. And whenever he was back from the Middle East or wherever he might be telling stories, he'd come through New York where I live and we'd catch up. And so, obviously, you know, the world came to know James Foley from the very infamous video that was released just 2 years ago, actually. We just kind of came past the 2 year anniversary of his death. And that video was obviously very surreal for family and friends still to this day. It was, you know, Jim kind of came onto the national scene through this propaganda video. And it was something that we all had to deal with. And one of my ways to deal with it was to, in an effort to kind of reclaim that video and take that away from what its intended purpose was. I wanted to do a film on my friend and tell the world who this man was, because he was somebody who was very different than what the intended purpose of his image was and how the world kind of got to know him.
There's a moment in the film where someone says that you'd have to be pretty stupid to risk your life for $300 a day. Now, I think anyone working as a journalist today would know that you don't really do anything in journalism for money. But even after Jim was rescued from Benghazi in 2011, his immediate act after that was to head straight back again. Do you think that he fully grasped the dangers that might face him in those parts of the world?
Well, it's a very complicated question. It's a great question. The reason that Jim returned to the region, ultimately, I think, is the thesis of this film. It's a question that a lot of us had. It's a question that a lot of people had. Why would you go back into these areas? And so answering that question was really important. And that question is answered through Jim's colleagues who are in the film. And it's a very layered answer. That's not a black and white answer. And so some of those layers are told from a perspective of, you know, when you're a conflict journalist and you are covering stories where children are being killed, civilians are being bombed, and you're witnessing some atrocities that people like us do not see, and you're covering that, you're in a world that becomes almost more real than the real world. And when you leave that and you come back to your safe home in the States or in Europe or wherever you might be, that world becomes almost unreal in the mind of a conflict journalist. And I think that's a very difficult environment to adapt to. And from what I've kind of learned and grasped from Jim's colleagues and other journalists is that it's hard for them to adapt into that world again. And there's this draw that takes you back to this conflict zone because it is so raw. There's so much tension going back. It's this siren song, as he says it. So that's kind of like one layer to it. That, you know, there's a post-traumatic stress that I think a lot of journalists suffer from on different levels. So, you know, kind of in a similar way that I think soldiers experience. And so there's the complications of that.
Brian Oakes, director of the new documentary Jim, the James Foley story, out in theatres now. You can hear my full interview with Brian on this week's edition of The Cinema Show, premiering at 2000 here in London. Catch up over at our website or wherever you get your podcasts. And that's it for today. Thanks to my guest, Oliver Meek. The Monocle Arts Review is produced by Holly Fisher and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. I'm Ben Ryland. Bye for now.